people in certain communities in rural Alaska are paying exorbitant and excessive prices, probably higher prices than they should be paying.
A new study shows what most Alaskans already know. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 2nd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Larry Persily shares his unique take on the Alaska gas line with the U.S. Senate.
Unlike wild salmon, where we know people will pay more for wild Alaska salmon, gas is a commodity. We just have to be competitive in the market on price.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist awards. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The results of a statewide survey released this week show Alaskans pay considerably more for their fuel than the rest of the U.S. It also found high price variations among communities within Alaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
The report of the survey by the Division of Community and Regional Affairs found heating oil prices averaging $5.36 a gallon and gasoline averaging $5.01 a gallon in Alaska. That's close to double national averages, showing heating oil at $2.99 a gallon and gasoline at $2.72. There are explanations for much of the fuel price differentials. High transportation costs, for example, as air deliveries needed in some communities. However, Anchorage Senator Bill Wilikowski says some unexplained discrepancies stand out.
If you look at this report, you see some interesting things. You see that you have various communities that are paying much, much more than other nearby communities. And you have to ask the question, why is that happening? And I think there's certainly an argument to be made that people in certain communities in rural Alaska are paying exorbitant and excessive prices, probably higher prices than they should be paying.
Wilikowski in the Senate and Anchorage Democrat Pete Peterson in the House have introduced bills that would allow the Department of Law to investigate and bring charges if necessary to find out whether Alaskans are paying too much for their fuel by retailers, distributors, or refineries. They want to know if there is price gouging. Peterson says he wants to get to the bottom of the issue.
The citizens of Alaska are questioning, and you see letters to the editor on a regular basis. I get emails, phone calls from constituents and people in other districts are saying, what's going on here? You know, people for their move to Alaska from other states, and they go, why is this so high here? And so they're asking the question, and we're trying to get the answer for them.
The two bills vary only a little. Wilikowski bases an investigation on refinery charges. Peterson's keys an investigation of price gouging on the difference between Alaska and Washington state prices. Wilikowski's says prices may not be unconscionable. Peterson says they shouldn't be exorbitant or excessive. They're talking about the same thing. And Peterson says the courts or the Attorney General's office could define them.
Historically, until the summer of 2008, there had never been a 10% margin of difference between Washington State and Alaska. Traditionally, it had been much less difference than that. And in some instances, we were actually lower than Washington State. And so all of a sudden, there had been this disconnect, and we were trying to find out why, and we're still trying to find out why.
Both bills leave an investigation to the Attorney General, and the Department of Law could ignore a price differential if there's an explanation from the supplier. As with all investigations, the findings would be kept secret. But if there's a conviction, the penalties could be stiff. 10 times the economic benefit of the supplier. Neither bill has been scheduled for hearings so far this year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
President Obama's choice to lead the office of the Federal Coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects faced a handful of senators in Washington today and assured them an Alaska gas line has a future. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Larry Persily said at his confirmation hearing before the Senate Energy Committee that an Alaska gas line is viable despite competition from Lower 48 supplies.
I pledge to devote my energy, my knowledge and ingenuity to the prospect of a very large and very long steel pipe to bring North Slope natural gas to America's consumers.
Only a few senators were on hand for the hearing, including the committee's top Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Alaska's other senator, Democrat Mark Begich, had recommended Persily to the White House and introduced him to the committee. Persily started his career in Alaska 30 years ago as a newspaper publisher and reporter and worked for the Knowles administration in the Revenue Department and in Governor Palin's Washington, D.C. office. He became an outspoken critic of Palin when she ran for vice president in 2008. Persily currently works as an oil and gas aide to Republican Representative Mike Hawker. Murkowski praised his ability to straddle the aisle.
He's not one to let partisan pressures stand in the way of building the project. Larry, I think it's fair to say we'll bring some refreshing candor. And that's, we laugh at it, a little politically correct there, but I think candor is necessary when you have something of this significance and import as we're looking at with this gas line.
Murkowski asked Persily how to tackle the hurdles that have kept a gas line from getting built, despite the fact that it's been talked about for decades.
Senator, I guess what I would bring to it is I just deal in reality. I've got to admit, I'm not much on process. I don't do vision statements very well. But to me, the reality...
We know what the vision is on this line.
Right, getting to the end of the line.
Yeah.
But we have to look at the reality of the numbers, the risk, the problems involved in this. Just because we want it isn't going to make it happen. So hopefully working with the parties, the state, the Canadian government, certainly the producers and TransCanada, the ones who are going to be putting their company's value on the line and seeing what can be done, where we can identify roadblocks, what can be done to remove them, see which parties are willing to take risk, and then with risk comes reward.
The office Persily would lead coordinates all aspects of building a gas line, which would be the largest private sector project ever built in North America. Last week, TransCanada, which hopes to build the line, estimated the project would cost in the range of $32 to $41 billion. Murkowski pointed out that's far higher than the $18 billion estimated just 6 years ago. She and Democratic Committee Chairman Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico questioned Persily about the risk that Alaska's gas won't be needed because of Lower 48 shale deposits. But Persily says the nation's need for natural gas is expected to rise, and he pointed out that while transportation costs are higher for Alaska's gas, the actual production costs will be lower than shale. He says project developers know they have to be competitive on price.
That's one of the hurdles they're working on. They know that a consumer wants natural gas at the burner tip. Unlike wild salmon, where we know people will pay more for wild Alaska salmon, gas is a commodity. We just have to be competitive in the market on price.
Persily says he believes the two projects currently competing for priority, one by TransCanada and ExxonMobil, and the other by BP and ConocoPhillips, will eventually merge, creating a deal that will involve all the companies. The Senate Energy Committee anticipates voting on his nomination as soon as next week. If his name successfully passes out of committee, which it's expected to do, the full Senate still has to confirm him. Right now, Republicans in the Senate are holding up many of the president's appointees by refusing to take confirmation votes. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Alaska has a new U.S. Marshal. Former Anchorage Police Chief Rob Hune was confirmed in the job by the U.S. Senate today. He was approved by unanimous consent after sitting on the Senate's calendar for a week and a half. Alaska's Democratic Senator and former Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich suggested Hune for the job to the Obama administration. Begich had complained last week that Republicans were holding up Hune's confirmation vote in the Senate. But today, Senator Murkowski said she was pleased Hune's confirmation went through the Senate as quickly as it did. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an innovative sled dog race gets set to make its first run.
It has the combination of things that all my years of racing I have found to be the best of all the races put together.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The Fairbanks man who started the Second Amendment Task Force says it spawned a local army and grassroots support across the country. Schaefer Cox says the group has 7,000 Fairbanks members, 3,500 of whom are part of a militia. Cox is a 25-year-old building contractor who's run for state house, but says he's turned his back on mainstream politics to focus on protecting individual freedoms. He says that's what the militia is all about.
It's called the Alaska Peacemakers Militia. And the slogan, the motto, you know, what's on our patches, it says, defend all, aggress none.
Cox says militia members are trained in basic gun and combat skills with the aim of being able to protect area residents from constitutional infringement, like gun control, or in the unlikely event of martial law. He has become a voice on government overreach and constitutional rights since he held the first Second Amendment Task Force meeting at a Fairbanks restaurant last spring. Cox says it's generated similar movements around Alaska and the lower 48.
All of these started in at Denny's in Fairbanks, and now they're all over the whole country, and I get several calls a day saying, now just how do we start this?
Cox says the movement sometimes attracts the attention of extremist groups, but true militias protect everyone's rights.
I don't want people to come around and tell me at gunpoint that I'm going to be a communist. And I don't want people to come around at gunpoint and tell me that I'm going to be a conservative right-wing Christian. I want liberty. I want my choices to be respected. And I want a government that is going to be there to make sure that I don't violate anyone else.
Cox believes the U.S. government will collapse and wants to be ready when it does. He's one of the three Alaska delegates participating in the Third Continental Congress, a citizen government reform effort strictly focused on upholding the U.S. Constitution. Legislation promoting electric cars is on its way to the governor's office. Senate Bill 59 allows the vehicles on more roads in villages and small cities, especially in Southeast. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
There's been a growing interest in small, low-speed electric cars and trucks in towns such as Sitka and Petersburg. Alternative energy advocate Jerry Herbranson says they're a great way to get around a place with a limited road system.
In our small communities, most of our trips are just a couple miles. Throughout the day, you may go 20 miles, but most of the trips are very short miles. And your internal combustion engines just do not warm up during that time, and that's hard on the engine, and it's the worst fuel efficiency during that time. So these little cars are actually ideal for these short hauls.
But they can't go everywhere their owners want to take them. That's because state law limits what roads they can use. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman decided to take up the issue after hearing about a problem in his hometown. A constituent complained that he was legally blocked from driving on portions of local roads because his car couldn't go fast enough.
Currently, there's a 35-mile-an-hour speed limit, and we have a lot of our roads on our islands in the district and throughout the region that have posted speed limits of 45 and less. So this would open up most of the roads in Southeast Alaska for electric automobiles.
His bill still keeps low-speed cars off of faster roadways, such as Juneau's 55-mile-per-hour Egan Drive. But he says the change will make the vehicles more practical in some communities. For example, Wrangell residents will now be able to drive a low-speed car to their airport legally. The 35-mile-per-hour limit was set to keep the vehicles, which travel at about 25, from slowing traffic too much. Stedman says that shouldn't be a big problem for Sitka.
I thought, well, that's kind of ridiculous because we've got a maximum speed of 45, 7 miles of road north and 7 miles south. Clearly, we're not in that big of a rush.
Stedman's bill just passed the House and Senate without opposition. It becomes law upon the governor's signature. Herbranson, who lives in Petersburg, sells the Miles brand of low-speed electric cars and trucks as part of his alternative energy business. The Zen brand is among other models used in the state. He says they're bigger than you'd think.
I'm over 6'6", and there's more body space in these vehicles than in my Chevy full-size pickup. They're amazing on space. There's other manufacturers that have two-person vehicles. But these are a hatchback. They have five doors, and you carry four adults very comfortably.
Per Branson's electric vehicles run between $14,000 and $16,000 each. Other models run $12,000 to $20,000. Unlike hybrids, they use no fuel and recharge by plugging into household current. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The total number of jobs in Anchorage will continue to fall throughout 2010. That was the assessment of state labor economist Neil Fried at his annual luncheon presentation to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce yesterday. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Asked when he thought Anchorage would emerge from the current recession, Fried said it's a prediction complicated by terminology.
The nation defines a recession with using gross national product. Well, we don't have those kind of numbers, so it's hard. I mean, I would not be surprised if our employment turned positive in 2011. There are people here that believe it's going to turn positive this year. And it's not just Northern Economics that predicted that. There are others. Moody's predicted that as well.
Last week at its annual January employment forecast, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation report also said a mild increase in job creation could occur late in 2010. Fried's description of where Anchorage jobs are likely to arise and disappear in 2010 did not veer greatly from other recently released forecasts. Fried predicts an overall Anchorage job loss of 0.7%. That's about 1,100 local jobs. The state economist pointed to a couple key features.
How sort of consistent it is and how few sectors are expected to grow in 2010. The other sort of significant thing is we don't see any huge losses either. You know, they're small, but they kind of add up, but don't add up to a huge number. Healthcare just sticks out there like a sore thumb. It just keeps on growing. It's amazing. And we're still behind the national curve, so we still have room to grow, and it's growing nationally as well.
The State Labor Department Anchorage 2010 forecast showed only two areas posting job increases, healthcare with 600 and government at 200. Fried noted that at least four 2010 economic forecasts had already taken place in the city. Given that well-tilled ground, he opted for dwelling on Anchorage's changing demographics. One of the most dramatic, he said, occurred recently and seems to be lessening a long-standing complaint among Anchorage employers.
A year and a couple months ago, the biggest problem employers had was finding people. And that cut across the board of all skill levels. Well, you don't hear that anymore. That's how quickly it changed. And it's not only because the number of jobs has declined some in here, but it's also because of the moderate influx of people coming to Alaska with all different skill sets.
2009 was marked by more people moving to Anchorage than leaving by nearly 3,200. That's the biggest influx for well over a decade. Fried also noted important to business plans and marketing is the city's population profile. Anchorage is becoming more diverse, as indicated by student enrollment, and the city has more young people at 32% than the national average, a trend continuing through 44-year-olds.
The Gen Ys, we have a few more of those, and the Gen Xs, we have more of those, and that makes me feel really good. Because, you know, everyone talks about the brain drain, we're losing our youth. Well, we have more of those pesky youth than the nation does as a whole.
Although it's the smallest sector at 10%, the over 60 group is also the fastest growing, with more and more older Anchorage folks opting to stay rather than moving south at retirement. In 1970, the median age in Anchorage was 23. In 2008, it was 33. For KSKA, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Fairbanks is experiencing one of its lowest snow seasons. Only 20.7 inches have fallen since July 1st, making this Fairbanks' 10th lowest snowfall season at this point. It snowed just 1 inch last month, the second smallest accumulation for January on record. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says the dry conditions are consistent with the current manifestation of the Pacific Ocean warming trend known as El Niño.
Typically in an El Niño pattern, we get more southerly flow in the upper atmosphere. So that tends to push moisture onshore along the coast, and then that moisture gets wrung out as it passes over the Alaska Range. And so we typically are pretty dry.
It's unclear if El Niño has peaked, but the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts it will continue to exert a significant influence on the global weather over coming months. Rader says El Niño effects aside, February, March, and April typically aren't that snowy. Last weekend's International Snow Sculpture Championships in Colorado left behind a garden of 12-foot-tall, cold white sculptures for the people of Breckenridge to gaze at. Their favorite in the competition was Team Alaska's The Last Iceberg. From member station KHNS, Tara Bicknell has more.
Ken Graham is one of the carvers on Skagway's Team Alaska, which won the People's Choice Award this year.
Yeah, we feel pretty good about that.
Last year, the team took home Kids' Choice and Judges' Choice for another bear-themed sculpture. Also among Skagway's five-person team this year was Douglas Smith. He explains The Last Iceberg, which is melting in Breckenridge as we speak.
It had a somewhat ecological theme to it, but it was really more of a joke. It was the last iceberg, and the idea is that polar caps have melted back so far. There's only one iceberg left, and thus there's only one polar bear left because he's only got one place to go. So it's this polar bear taking refuge on the last iceberg, and Hunter comes along and sees this thing looming over him as he goes through the arch underneath the iceberg. He pokes it with a spear, and as he does so, the bear steals his fish.
This year, Team Alaska competed against carvers from Lithuania, China, Canada, and Mexico, which practices their sculpting with a specialized sand-based compound. Graham says Team Alaska doesn't get much practice, even living in snow country.
You really don't have a chance to practice unless somebody wants to build you a 10-foot cube of snow.
The monolithic snow carvings all started out as super compressed snow blocks made by volunteer stompers who dance on the encased snow as it's built in increments.
So you start out with the grid, and then you start making marks, and you cut into that. And that's actually, for me, was the most intimidating part that really kind of blew my mind, is how you start with basically two-dimensional plane on four sides and making that into a 3D object. It's amazing.
Team Alaska's next carving event is Whitehorse's Snow Sculpture Challenge in late February. In Skagway, I'm Tara Bicknell.
You've heard of tennis doubles. Now a famous Alaskan musher wants to transfer the concept to his sport. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King has been known for being an innovative person when it comes to mushing gear. While King's now getting creative with the sport of sled dog racing itself, he started a new race called the Denali Doubles.
Well, the Denali Doubles sled dog race is an invitational race. It has the combination of things that all my years of racing I have found to be the best of all the races put together.
The race begins and ends in Cantwell with the midpoint in Paxson. King says the loop is 265 miles, and here is where the innovation begins.
The main difference between the Denali Doubles race is that two mushers will be required to be with each team of dogs. So any entrant in the race is going to include two mushers, one of which has to have demonstrated a previous ability to participate with some pre-race qualifications. And then the second musher of their choice to go along.
The first musher must have either came in the top five, received the Humanitarian Award, or have finished as Rookie of the Year in a past race. The race is limited to 20 teams, and so far 19 teams have signed up. And according to the race rules, if a musher is caught whining, they're fined $75.
That's up from $50. There was a modification to the rules. It originally said there's a $50 fine for whining. I'm big on the old adage, the truth is often spoken jest. And clearly, I am jesting when I add the rule of $75 fine for whining. And yet the truth is, over my 30 years of dog mushing, one of the things that's not been fun for me is to hear some of my comrades whining about the rules or the conditions.
At the 2009 ceremonial start of the Iditarod, King's G-Pole sled got some second glances, and he hopes the Denali doubles will spark an interest in G-Poling for other mushers.
Which is where one of the mushers rides skis in front of the sled, the other one rides the back where most people are familiar with seeing the mushers. The majority of the teams will probably have a tandem tag sled where one conventional dog sled is tied to another conventional dog sled with their 20-dog team in front of them.
And King says he created the two-person teams partly because he simply gets bored in races like the nearly 1,200-mile Iditarod, and that traveling with another person will just be a lot more fun.
And fun translates into more participation. Because the two mushers can talk to one another, they can exchange ideas as they go down the trail, one can safely hold the team while the other one goes up to replace a booty or switch a dog around. And the area that we are racing on is an area that's difficult to anchor your team down if you were a single musher.
King says he will sit this race out and is one of three race judges. The four-time Iditarod champion says if the race proves to be as much fun as he thinks it will be, the Denali doubles will become an annual event. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kneen.
What's Groundhog Day in the rest of the country is now Marmot Day in Alaska. A bill signed into state law last year designates February 2nd as Marmot Day. The change is aimed at Alaskanizing the holiday, but Link Olson, a biologist and curator of mammals at the University of Alaska Museum of the North, says Alaska's three species of marmot include the groundhog.
Which up here goes by the common name woodchuck, but it's the same species as Punxsutawney Phil, and the groundhogs that we see all the way back to the East Coast. Their distribution includes a little sort of finger that comes all the way up to interior Alaska.
Wasilla Senator Linda Menard sponsored the Marmot Day bill, pushing the designation as a way to encourage marmot educational events and activities. Meanwhile, Punxsutawney Phil is reported to have seen his shadow today in Pennsylvania, indicating six more weeks of winter, a forecast that normally doesn't stretch as far north as his species ranges. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Lorelei Kneen in Nome, and Tara Bicknell in Skagway. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.